The Sufi poet Rumi once wrote, "Out beyond ideas of right and wrongdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there." It's in that place that nonviolent communication helps us to live. It's quite a different world than this world of right-doing and wrongdoing, in which we decide whether the person deserves to suffer or deserves to be rewarded. In the world that Rumi is talking about, we see that compassionate giving is what is our nature and which is the most fulfilling way for us to live. Long before I reached adulthood, I had already learned to communicate in the impersonal moralistic judgments. These do not require us to reveal what's alive in us. They simply require us to judge people. When I encountered people or behavior I either didn't like or didn't understand, I was educated to react in terms of their wrongness. If my teachers assigned a task I didn't want to do, they were mean or unreasonable. If somebody pulled out in front of me in traffic, I might react by thinking or saying, "You idiot." When we speak this language, we think and communicate in terms of what's wrong with others for behaving as they do, or what's wrong with ourselves for behaving as we do. Our attention is focused on classifying, analyzing, and determining levels of wrongness rather than on whether life is being served or not. When I'm communicating in the way I was programmed to communicate, if my life partner wants more affection than I'm giving, she is needy and dependent. But if I want more affection than I'm receiving, she's aloof and insensitive. If my partner is more concerned about details than I am, she's picky and compulsive. On the other hand, if I'm more concerned about details than she is, she is sloppy and disorganized. It's my belief that all such analyses of other human beings are tragic expressions of our own values and needs. They're tragic because when we express our values and needs in this form, we increase defensiveness and resistance to them among the very people who are of concern to us. Or if they do agree to act in harmony with our values, because they are convinced when people respond to our needs, will likely do so out of fear, guilt, or shame. And we pay dearly, I'm convinced, when people respond to our needs, not out of desire to give from their heart, but out of fear, guilt, or shame. Sooner or later, we will experience the consequences of a diminished goodwill on the part of those who comply with our needs out of this sense of worrying about punishment or some kind of guilt inducement. Further, each time others associate us in their minds with guilt or fear or shame, we decrease the likelihood of their responding compassionately to our needs and values in the future. The relationship between language and violence is the subject of psychology professor O.J. Harvey's research at the University of Colorado. He took random samples of pieces of literature from many countries over the world and tabulated the frequency of words that classify and judge people. His study shows a high correlation between the frequent use of such words and incidences of violence. It doesn't surprise me to hear that there is considerably less violence in cultures where people think in terms of human needs than in cultures where people label one another as good or bad, right or wrong, normal or abnormal, and they believe that the bad people deserve to be punished. I feel great pain when I see how many of the programs that children are watching on television in which the heroes, in the course of the program, either kill or beat somebody up. Walter Wink, the theologian, has helped me immensely to understand where this all began. He helps me in his book, The Powers That Be, to see that for about 8,000 years we have been programmed to think in these moralistic judgments, to continue to have justice based on these judgments, which imply that If people are judged one way, they deserve to suffer and be punished. If they're judged another way, they deserve to be rewarded. There is another way, and I'm glad that we'll have a chance to explore this as we go along. This other way being, let's not judge each other right or wrong. Let's connect in a way in which we continue to enjoy contributing to one another's well-being. Now, I'd like to outline for you some other ways in which we have been educated to communicate and influencing each other that I'm sad about, that I think contribute to great pain. Another one is making comparisons between ourselves and other people. Dan Greenberg, in his book, How to Make Yourself Miserable, demonstrates through humor the insidious power that comparative thinking can have over us. He suggests that if readers have a sincere desire to make life miserable for themselves, they might learn to compare themselves to other people. For those unfamiliar with this practice, he provides a few exercises. The first one displays pictures of a man and a woman who embody ideal physical beauty by contemporary media standards. Readers are instructed to take their own body measurements, compare them to those superimposed on the pictures of the attractive specimens, and dwell on the differences. This exercise produces what it promises. We start to feel miserable as we engage in these comparisons. By the time we're as depressed as we think possible, we turn the page to discover that this first exercise, getting us to compare ourselves physically, was a mere warm-up. Since physical beauty is relatively superficial, Greenberg now provides an opportunity to compare ourselves on things that matter more, such as achievement. He resorts to the phone book to give readers a few random individuals to compare themselves with. The first name he claims to have pulled out of the phone book is Wolfgang Mozart. Greenberg lists the languages Mozart spoke and the major pieces he had composed by the time he was a teenager. The exercise then instructs readers to recall their own achievements at their current stage of life, and then compare them with what Mozart had accomplished by age 12, and to dwell on the differences. Even readers who never emerge from the self-induced misery of this exercise might see how powerfully this type of thinking blocks compassion, both for ourselves and others. Another kind of communication that disconnects us from life and contributes to great suffering is the denial of responsibility. Such communication clouds our awareness that we are each responsible for our own thoughts, feelings, and actions. The use of the common expression, have to, as in there are some things you have to do, whether you like it or not, illustrates how personal responsibility for our actions is obscured in such speech. Or the phrase, makes one feel, as in, you make me feel guilty, is another example of how language facilitates the denial of personal responsibility for our own feelings and thoughts.